SiriusXM is a fan's field of dreams.
I can hear every game.
From the first pitch to the last out of the World Series.
What about my hometown announcers?
They're on the SiriusXM app. They built it knowing you would come.
Ray, there's even an entire radio channel filled with experts talking baseball all day long.
Is this heaven?
No, Ray. It's MLB Network Radio, Channel 89.
Experience Negro Leagues 101, a celebration of the 101st anniversary of the founding of the Negro Leagues at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City. For more information, plus event schedules, video exhibits, and safety guidelines, visit NLBM.com and follow the museum on Twitter at NLBMuseumKC and follow Bob at NLBMPrez.
Henry was the third child of eight born to Mr. and Mrs. Herbert Aaron. In 1934 in Mobile, Alabama, a black family, you know they didn't have very much. And now, indeed, I'm sure the cup has run us over. And now, as yours do, the world takes another turn and life moves on. It's 3-3, and the batter is Dusty Baker, and this crowd is beside itself with joy.
Former Atlanta Braves pitcher Tom House.
Dusty Baker and Ralph Garr were buddies of mine, and Henry kind of took both of them under wing as a mentor. Check out Dusty Baker's career, and I'll guarantee you a large part of his development, both on and off the field, was hanging around with Henry.
In part one of our look back at the life and times of Henry Aaron, we reflected on his Negro League roots as a youngster leaving Mobile, Alabama in 1952 to go join the Indianapolis Clowns. In part two, I welcome his former teammate, his former Atlanta Braves teammate, two-time All-Star, World Series champion, National League Championship MVP winner in 1977, three-time Manager of the Year, the great Dusty Baker joins us to talk about his friend, his teammate, Henry Aaron. Dusty, man, first and foremost, welcome to Black Diamonds, and how are you?
I'm doing fine, and I must admit that, you know, the two statues that I got from you for Manager of the Year, man, those are amongst my proudest ones on my mantelpiece in my memorabilia room. So, hey, you know, thanks for that. My son's always asking about it and is asking about the, you know, questions about the Negro League, and whoever comes over to my house asks me about that. So, you know, I just want to thank you very much for everything that you've done for me.
Hey, man, we are so appreciative of everything that you've done to help raise the profile of the Negro Leagues, and certainly the many times that you've come and visited the museum, and you always come with someone. You bring right. some other people along with you. I'll never forget bringing Bryce Harper here. You have some really interesting connections to the Negro Leagues, and we've talked about this. Right. When you joined the Braves in 68, who's there with you hanging out? The legendary Satchel Paige.
Oh,
Satchel
yeah.
had come in with Bill Bartholomew had brought Satchel back to join the Braves to help Satchel. They all thought Satchel was a little shy of getting his pension. And so he brings Satchel back to join the Braves, and Satchel's going to be a pitching coach slash trainer. What was it like hanging out with Satchel Paige?
Well, it was great. You know, he was full of stories. You didn't know if he was telling the truth or not, but it was always entertaining. And what you had heard about Satch was exactly true. I mean, this guy, he was in great shape. You know, I was in charge of Ralph Garr and myself of carrying all his fishing rods, because he carried everywhere that we went. People would give him stuff, and he promised me that at the end of the year he was going to give me a fishing rod, which he never did. but you know, we carried all his stuff, and you know, he always carried around this little bag with the 2x4 in it, and it would a catcher's glove, and he asked me to go down and catch him in the bullpen, and I put the 2x4 across the plate, and he says no, he called me Daffy, and
yes, he yes. never
get my name right, and I said, man, my name is Dusty. He said, man, I know what your name is, Daffy. And so you know, he would have me put the 2x4 width-wise on the corners. And I don't know how old Satch was. He never would admit his age, but he was throwing strikes at that age. And, you know, he said, stay out of the training room. You know, he didn't believe in ice. You know, he believed in heat.
Yes.
And he said he never had a sore arm. And, you know, just his, he was full of stories. And he used to crack Hank Aaron up because every time, and, you know, Hank liked to laugh. He loved to laugh. It didn't take much for Sats to, you know, at that time it was Ralph Gar. Tommy Aaron was always there, Hank's brother. And so we'd go down to Hank or Satchel's room after the game. And, you know, here I was a little kid, you know, because I had heard about Satch. You know, my dad, you know, would always get the sepia, get the ebony, and get the Pittsburgh Courier.
Yes.
So they'd always write articles about Satch. And, you know, my dad was, you know, was big and in baseball, and he loved Satchel Paige as well as Hank Aaron.
Yeah. Well, they tell me that Satchel used to have a briefcase.
Correct.
And in that briefcase was a lot of various alcohol in that briefcase. Did he have the briefcase with him?
I never saw him drink, though, that tell you the truth. And maybe he didn't want me to see him. But at that, you know, at the time, I was 19 years old.
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
You know, like he tell me to go get a soda water. And, all those guys used to take care of me. They called me the kid.
Yes, I
was known as the kid for a long time. I mean, guys that knew my name or didn't know my name, they always called me the kid.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you used to warm him up, because one of the stories that I heard, and again, you don't ever know whether these things are true or not, but, you know, they say that, you know, Satchel and Henry Aaron, they're on the back, in the back of the bus, holding court. And Henry says, Satchel, you never would have gotten that fastball by me. Yeah. You know, and you know, Henry believed that, because he said, I never looked for a fastball because I didn't think anybody could get one by me.
Right.
And he said, and Satchel looks at him, he says, Hammer, if I'd have been pitching to you, I'd have unbuttoned that top button.
Yeah. And I tell you, he told me one day, and I've used this with my pitchers. He said, 1-2 count. He says, do you know what this ball under your chin? He says, would you know, I would throw you the 1-2 fastball and it fits perfectly right under your chin here. And he called it the throat cutter. And he says that you would swing at it and try to stop your swing and then cut your own throat off and then look back at the umpire to see if you swung or not, and then your head would fall off. And I tell the guys, don't throw the throat cutter 3-2s. They may not swing at it. Don't throw 2-2, because if you don't swing at it, now it's 3-2. Don't swing at it 0-2, because, you know, they expect you to waste one. But he said the perfect time to throw the throat cutter is 1-2.
And that is priceless. I never got to meet him. I never got to meet him. I felt like I knew him because of all the stories that Buck used to tell about Satchel. And he used to play checkers at a little gas station here in Kansas City on 31st and Prospect. I'm a kid here at that time, you know, in college. And he dies in 1982. And when he passes away, the national media descended on Kansas City. But there were people in the neighborhood had no idea how great Satchel Paige really was. And the other connection, and that is the focus of this week's podcast, is on the great Henry Aaron, whose career began in the Negro Leagues, as you well know, with the Indianapolis Clowns. And you're there with Henry Aaron, and you're there during his chase of Roof's record. And I remember this vividly, because I'm almost 12 years old when Henry Aaron breaks Roof's record. And I grew up in a little town, Dusty, called Crawfordville, Georgia. Mm-hmm. It was just 80 miles east of Atlanta, 50 miles west of Augusta. And I remember this as a kid, how divided my little town was. Now, again, in this little old town, which is still, for the most part, even in the 1970s, it was pretty segregated. So the old white men sat on one corner on the other side, and the old black men sat on the other corner across from each other.
Right.
And there was this tension as the hammer was growing closer to breaking Ruth's record. You were there. What was that time span and that period like for you as you're watching this transpire?
Well, there was a lot of tension, period, a lot of tension in the country at that time. You know, a lot of racial unrest. Actually, I 1972 and three, I sold cars down in Augusta, Georgia.
Did you really?
Yeah, at Walker Ford. And I remember that, you know, I wasn't allowed to go, you know, to the Augusta National, you know, at that time. And it was, you know, I mean, the whole world seemed like it was segregated, at least in that.
In that neck of the woods.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember being with Hank, myself, like I said, and Ralph Garr. And we'd go to dinners with Hank, and we'd always go to NAACP meetings and go to meetings because he was big in civil rights movement. And, we'd go over to Maynard Jackson's house, who was the mayor. We'd go to Andrew Young's house, you know, who was his real good friend. Even, you know, when he died, we'd go with Ted Abernathy, and, you know, everybody wanted to be around Hank. And also we'd go to Chicago, go to Jesse Jackson's house and have dinner and just talk about different, you know, the different issues of our, of that time and in the country. And, you know, not only was Hank Babe Ruth, but he was also, I don't know how he found the energy and the time, you know, to spend as much in the community. And he was always about helping young people, whether black or white, but especially black people, educating them, you know, giving away scholarships. And,
yes.
You know, and at that time, you know, Hank had two rooms. He had a room that he slept in, and he had a room that he was registered under. And Hank had a bodyguard with us all the time in Calvin Wardlow. And, you know, we'd go to Hank's room and entertain him every night because he was under, you know, tremendous pressure. He was under, you know, getting death threats. And I mean, yeah. Getting all kind of racial, you know, hate mail from all over the country, because Babe Ruth was the epitome of, you know, of American baseball. I mean, Babe Ruth was even I used to watch, you know, some of the war movies, and, you know, the Germans would be trying to infiltrate, you know, the American lines, and the number one question they'd ask the guy was, who's Babe Ruth? And if he couldn't answer it, that meant that he was an infiltrator or a spy. and even I'd see this, you know, in the movies, whether it was true or not, you know, the kamikaze pilots would dive down upon a destroyer or whatever and holler, Baby Ruth, Baby Ruth. And so, yeah. You know, Babe Ruth was the man. And, and I remember when Hank was going for that record, I mean, you know, one day he hit a ball and we thought it was out. And Hank told me that Babe Ruth blew that back because Babe Ruth, didn't want him, you know, to break the record. But, you know, all the hate mail, and I mean, Hank taught us that you can be driven to excellence and concentration and reverse, you know, that thought process that would have crushed, you know, a normal man. I mean, it motivated Hank big time. And he was bent on breaking that record. Because I remember the year he broke the record, you know, we went to spring training. And he was working on hitting home runs only in spring training. I think he got 11 hits that spring, and 10 of them were home runs. and he told me that he was perfecting how to hit home runs. And his concentration level was beyond compare. And he knew what was coming, like, almost all the time. I mean, through process of elimination and the situation of the game, you know, I mean, this guy was one of the smartest men, not only on the field, but off the field as well. And one of the strongest, most disciplined guys. This is what people don't understand. Hank trained. I mean, he trained like nobody's business. And, you know, he'd go play handball first, and then he was an excellent racquetball player. And Ralph Garo and I would go train, and we'd play basketball, and Hank would just run around the gym like the whole, like 2 hours we were playing basketball. This guy was in, you know, tremendous shape. And I remember one time he gave me a challenge of everybody talks about how strong his wrists and hands were and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he worked on that. And Hank told me that, you know, I asked him, how did you get so strong? He said he used to work on the ice truck. And most people mm-hmm. don't remember what ice truck was. I barely remember the ice man coming around, you know, back, you know, when I was a kid. And, you know, that was your refrigeration, you know, was ice. And then Hank gave me a challenge that, take the newspaper and fold it open, and then take each page and then start in the center and then ball it up and then throw it away and then do the other hand and ball it up. And this was a Sunday paper and, you know, that he would take. And he always had hand grips or rubber balls or something to make his forearms and hands. And so he gave me the paper, and I think I did like 3 or 4 pages. And then my arms were burning. Hank did the whole paper. You know what I mean? And like I said, he was not only physically strong, had tremendous vision and balance, but, you know, he had uncanny concentration. I mean, this guy, and him and Barry Bonds had the same kind of focus, concentration, and vision. And when people ask me what similarities that, and I remember when he went to Japan to have a home run hitting contest with Sadahata Oh. And, you know, he told me there's no way that Sadahata, you know, was going to beat him. And I used to, as a kid, I used to watch Home Run Derby. I think he was Home Run Derby, you know, with Harmon Killebrew and Bob Allison and Ernie Banks and all those guys. I think he won that, Home Run Derby. And Hank used to tell us all the time that, you know, I never saw him hit a tape measure home run not one time. And we'd go to the Astrodome, he'd hit in the front row, and which is huge. We'd go to Chicago, he hit it right in the basket. So I said, Hank, man, what kind of gauge do you have on your bat? Can you hit ace of sun? It's not how far, it's how many. And he always reminded me to try to be as consistent as possible. I was leadoff man in the minor leagues, and then they put me behind Hank in the big leagues. And, you know, I can't protect Hank Aaron. And I asked Hank, I said, well, you know, what do? I use that today. And I says, hey, you know, if they walk, Hank said, if they walk you, he says, do not strike out, because he hated strikeouts. He said, you can't help your team striking out. And if that runner's on third base, you got to get him home. And he told me, he says, keep the ball off the ground and just concentrating on getting hits. You get hits, they will stop walking me. And I remember one time I asked Hank, he got a bunch of hanging curve balls and a bunch of nothing sinkers. And I said, man, you know, and then I'd come up there after he hit a home run, the ball just darting. And I said, man, they pitching me like they should you, and you like, you know, like they should me. And he told me, he says, boy, he says, they're not afraid of you. And he says, fear will make a pitcher tighten up and throw that curveball that doesn't curve and that sinker that doesn't sink. But he says, after I've done the damage, he says, the worst guy to face is a relaxed pitcher. And he says, a relaxed pitcher, his forearms are loose and the ball just runs and that does what it's supposed to do, you know, naturally. And, you know, I learned so much from Hank, you know, hitting behind him. You know, he would tell me certain things and he'd say, hey, boy, do you understand? And I'd say, yeah, I'd always say, yeah. And he knew I'd understand. And he goes, look, I know you don't understand, but he says, the key to this game is to have total recall of every situation and every pitcher, because they didn't have printouts and scouting reports then. You had to remember what a guy did. If you don't know his name, you got to remember his windup or remember his walk. Hank had total recall of everything. And I remember one day he told me, he said, man, watch this. He says that shortstop is going to move to the hole, one step to his right. He's going to throw me a breaking ball. I've been watching him all game, and so I said, "Okay, Hank." So the guy moved, and so he says, "You see what I was talking about?" I didn't see him move. I didn't see nothing. And then 5 years later, I saw Ozzie Smith moving that hole over there. And Pete Bukovich threw me a breaking ball, and it reminded me that Hank told me, you may not understand, which I try to tell my players now, but just retain what you're taught and what you learn. And I use a lot of the stuff. They probably get tired of me talking about Hank Aaron, but he was in the outfield, he rarely had to dive for a ball. If he needed a stolen base, he would steal it. He was a great base runner. He was a guy less than two outs on third base. He said, watch the batter, the flight of the ball through the zone, and you will tell if it's a line drive. So you never get doubled off, or you can tell if it's a ground ball off his bat if you watch the flight of the bat. And they told me he never got thrown out, you know, at the plate. And I remember when I was was with Hank, Sandy Koufax was one of my heroes on the Dodgers because I grew up in outside of LA. And I asked Hank, I said, hey, man, you know, who's the toughest guy for you to face? You know, he told me Sandy Koufax. So when I got to the Dodgers later on, I'm in spring training sitting down in the bullpen with Sandy. I wasn't playing that day. And, you know, to sit with Sandy Koufax and talk baseball, man, that was like going to heaven as well as hanging around Hank. So I asked Andy, who's the toughest hitter that you had to face? And without hesitation, he told me Bad Henry. That's what he called it. I'm like, now, wait a minute now. How is each one of them's tough guy is each other? You know what I mean? And I found that, and the thing that he hated pitchers that cheated, that would load the ball up or scuff the ball up. You know, he didn't like that. If you had to cheat to get him out, I mean, he could not stand that. But, you know, I mean, he was a model of consistency. I mean, he told me to play 150 games a year. I mean, I think he averaged 100, and he said 12 games a year. I use that now with my players, 12 games a year, which is two games off a month. You know, you're doing nothing but occupying ink on the lineup card, because they're 12 games a year that, you know, like you're there, but you're not really there in high concentration or physical. And so, like I said, I used a lot of the stuff that Hank told me in my managing today.
You know, I find it interesting, Dusty. I don't know if he gets enough credit for having been such a tremendous student of the game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't think he gets enough credit either, because, you know, something, he never bragged about what he knew. And, you know, I've read some parables that a wise man doesn't always let everybody know how smart he is. And, you know, like Hank, you know, he never, him, Sandy Koufax, and Lou Brock were probably the most humble superstars that I ever met, because if you didn't know who they were, they would not have told you, made sure that they knew who you were. They never bragged about what they did, nothing. But he was always in the game, always, always. And I see some of the guys now, their heads are down during the game watching the iPad. Well, Hank never took his eye off the game, never took his eye off of, you know, I remember one day this guy was getting him out. And so he had his hand up over his eye like this. And I mean, he made it in his fist and looking through the hole. And I'm like, I'm looking at him. And then he took his cap off and he looked in even a smaller hole in the top of the cap. And I'm like, Damon, what are you looking at? And he told me he's looking at the guy's release point. And he says, I got him. And I'm like, what you got, Hank? And he told me, but you know, I never did see it until later. And I tell our guys, man, you got to pay attention. I remember there was a guy playing left field, and Hank says, if I hit a single to left, this guy drops his head right before he throws the ball, and I'm going to just be in my gate like he had, like it's a single. And as soon as this guy drops his head, bam, I'm going to take off and be on second base. And he did it. And, you know, that taught me that, you know, the coaches can teach you one thing, but a fellow player can tell you, teach you, and then show you how to play.
Yes.
And nowadays we're trying to run the older players out of the game at a certain age, but these older players are playing coaches, you know, and it's easy for us to emulate a player. I mean, guys know everybody's batting stance, they know everybody's wind up. You know, we got to keep some of these guys around because they are teachers on the job training, and not only can teach you, tell you, but can show you what to do as well.
Yeah. Now, in 74, you're a young ball player, and you're watching this tumultuous episode unfold. When did it dawn on you, Dusty, that you were a part of something really special? When did you really fully grasp and appreciate what you had gone through with Henry Aaron?
Probably, I don't know, 5-10 years afterwards, to tell you the truth. Because, you know, it was just part of being around the hammer. And then, you know, the longer I played, the more I respected and realized what he did, what he went through. Because you know, while you're in the act of something, you're not thinking about anything. You know what I mean? You were like just, you know, I was on deck circle with Hank. You know, I put my hat on top of my helmet on top of my hat like Hammer. And then the Hammer, you know, would tell me things on deck circle. And like he would give me a game plan. He always had a plan. You know, he said, Tom Seaver, he said, Dusty, you make him get the ball below the waist because if he couldn't catch up to it, that ball upstairs, I dang sure couldn't catch up to it upstairs. And so I hit Tom Seaver pretty good because he gave me a theory and a philosophy. And he said, Steve Carlton, if it's spinning from the hips down, take it because it's going to be a ball if you swing at it. So, see, he always had a plan. And just like today, I tell my players, any plan is better than no plan. It may not make any sense to me.
Yeah.
But it's your plan.
It's your plan.
It's your plan. And I am a firm, you know, believer in that. And, you know, he made us like he promised my mom when I signed that he would take care of me as if I was his son. And, you know, like he made me go to church. He made me like, you know, come in. He was so disciplined. And the only time he would have a drink or two is if we had a day game today and a night game tomorrow or before an off day. And Ralph Gar were in charge, especially during that year, we were in charge of making him laugh on the plane because, you know, he loved to laugh. And, you know, like he would, I wasn't big on breakfast. I was big on, you know, hanging out a little bit and then sleep half the morning. And then, man, he's telling me to get up and have breakfast. That's the most important meal. So, you know, I wouldn't get up and have no breakfast. And then somebody starts sending breakfast to my room that I had to pay for. You know how you put that card outside your door? Deliver ham and eggs and some grits at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. And I was like, I didn't order any ham and eggs. And I found out it was Hank doing it. And so, you know, like he would eat his meal about between noon and 1 o'clock every day, eat his big meal. And if he got late and had to do something, and then later on, I mean, we didn't know anything about nutrition, but, you know, and if he ate after 2 o'clock, then he would eat chicken, fish or pasta, something that he could digest, you know, because if you eat too late, you feel better after the game than you did during the game.
Yeah.
Or you can't go in and you know, take your dump right before the game. And he explained to me that, hey, man, when you go to the racetrack or dog track, you know, people would bet on the dog that would, take a crap like right before the race. Because he said that dog is light. You know what I mean? And so, you know, he had all these theories that worked. And I try to do the same. I try to do the same thing. I mean, not to that magnitude or degree, but, you know, he set my, and at the time when I got drafted, Bob, the thing that I prayed to the Lord that I would not get drafted by the Atlanta Braves, because I was 1967 and, you know, there was unrest, there was, you know, riots, and there was, you know, especially, I mean, all over the country. And I really didn't want to go to the South.
Exactly.
And so, but that ended up being the best thing that ever happened to me in my life.
Yeah.
I got to really meet all these, you know, civic leaders, got to be around Hank and his family. And I was closer in age to his kids than I was to him. And, you know, was with him every day, ate over his house all the time, hung out in his room, and, you know, got to see what it was like to, you know, to really be a proud, intelligent Black man. And, yes. and it gave me more pride in being a Black man than if I'd have stayed in California, where a lot of times I might have been, and I look back upon it, that I was fooled that somebody liked me, where when I went to the South, you know, and everybody in the South, just because they had a draw, which I had to learn, you know, was not a racist.
Exactly.
In the Klan.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so, you know,
you're absolutely
big.
Right.
I mean, that was big for me, you know, to learn at that time, because if I heard a Southern drawl right away, you think that, hey, man, this cat ain't no good. Yeah. Well, where I come from, California, there was no draw, but I ended up learning that, you know, some of the people out there ain't no good. They just don't tell you. You know what I mean? So, like I said, I learned a lot about, you know, about life and about myself from being in the South.
Yeah. One final question for you, Dusty, because I know you got to get to the business at hand, and that's trying to help your Astros continue to win games and get into these playoffs. And were you ever afraid for Henry during that chase of Rudy?
Yeah, a lot. And that's why he had two rooms. You know what I mean? And I remember one day, you know, like he would never let me read it, but he would like the letters, but he would, he'd go in the training room. And he also taught me how to play with pain, because this guy was in tremendous pain. He had a bad sciatica, he had a bad back. And, you know, I mean, he taught me, and the thing that I was most proud of was never going on disabled list, because he taught us, you got to go out there and play. And he would limp in like Fred Sanford, man, and then some kind of way, you know, he'd read these letters, think away pain, go to the training room, and then walk out, run like Bob Hayes, and walk back in like Fred Sanford. And I was like, how are you doing this? Well, like I said, a lot of this, you know, was motivated by some of these letters that he had. And he would like, I could tell it was a bad letter, because he'd throw it down on the ground. And then Ralph Garr and I would read it when he was gone. And, you know, like he was like a father trying to protect your kids from reality. But, you know, I was a curious guy and I wanted to see reality. And I remember one day there was a letter that said that there was a guy going to be in Atlanta Fulton County Stadium with a red jacket on, and he was going to shoot Hank Aaron during the game. And me and Ralph let Hank know that we had read it. And me and Ralph and I are looking all around everywhere for that guy in the red jacket. Hank act like it wasn't even a reality. And, you know, Ralph and I were kind of scared in case you know, he was going to shoot Hammer and miss Hammer and hit he's a bad shot, you know what I mean? And so Ralph and I are like, hey, you know, we down with you, man. You know, we with you. But me and Ralph couldn't even play the game because the whole game, we looking for that guy in the red jacket. Yeah. But it never, ever phased Hank, ever. Yeah. It might have phased him inside, but he didn't show it.
The strength that he demonstrated, I mean, it's unfathomable to think what that period must have been like. And yet he was laser focused on getting the task at hand. You're on the on deck circle when he hits that historic home run. And, you know, in closing, what do you recall about that moment?
Well, I recall that it was an extremely cold night in April. Unseasonably cold. And Hank told me, he said, I'm gonna get this over with right now. I said, okay. I mean, because he wasn't predicting his home runs like Muhammad Ali predicted, like he was gonna knock people out, but he would tell me what a guy was gonna do. He's gonna do this, gonna do that. I'm hitting him over right center field fence. Or he said, I'm gonna get this over with right now. I said, okay. And then I recall that boom, Al Downing threw it, he hit it over the fence. And I could have been the first one up there. You know, if I even thought about history, you know, to greet him. But to me, I didn't want to be up there because that was Hank's moment.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that wasn't my moment. That was his moment. And then they stopped the game. His mom, dad came down, you know, Dorinda, Larry, Hanky, Gail, they all came down. And then, you know, they, you know, at the time when he was around the bases, there are a couple of kids out there, mm-hmm. but you know, you didn't think about, you know, those kids would have tried to, you know, harm Hank. You could tell, you know, that they, or else we'd have been the first ones out there. You know, I mean, they thought it was a great moment.
Yeah.
Especially you'd like to think that, you know, there were some cool white kids that really appreciated that at that time, just like Vin Scully. You know, Black Man in the South got a standing ovation, and that was a big moment, that not only for Hank, but it was a big moment, you know, for America. And then they stopped the game, and then, you know, I'm like, hey, man, and I heard this, I was going on deck circle, and I heard a bunch of clanking, because the seats were loud, and I heard clank, 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 and I turned around, everybody's leaving, so... Like, wait a minute, man, I'm about to hit you guys. So, you know, I care that about me hit, you know? So, and I was trying to hit a home run, you know, and, you know, as a tribute to Hank. And, you know, I think I hit a double. At least I got a hit, I think. I didn't remember, but that was a great moment. And then things went south for all of us. You know, the Braves offered... They didn't offer Hank a contract. Then they offer him a job, like a meet and greet job. And he wasn't ready to retire yet. And that's when he went to Milwaukee.
Yes.
And then Hank was our protector. You know, if he had a salary dispute or he had a dispute with anything and anybody, Ralph Garr, myself, you know, Darrell Evans, Marty Perez, all of us would go, Mike McQueen, all of us would go to Hank. And Hank would, you know, some kind of way take care of it. And then when Hank left, man, it just, you know, we were lost. And then the next year, after the next year, they traded all of us. They traded myself to L.A. They traded Ralph Garr to White Sox, traded Darrell Evans and Marty Perez to the Giants. They traded Ron Reed, I think, to Philadelphia. You know, they traded us all. And,
yeah.
You know, when Hank left, you know, that's why I requested a trade. That's why I was ready to go.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, man, it was so special for me as a kid to witness that moment, which I still think is the greatest sports accomplishment in my lifetime,
mm-hmm.
was watching my childhood idol break Babe Ruth's record. And you were a part of that. You have obviously carved out your own niche, but to be connected to the Hammer and the way that you were. I know that means a great deal to you. It means a great deal to us. And Dusty Baker, I cannot thank you enough, man, for taking out some time to be part of this episode as we reflect on the life and times of the great Henry Aaron. Thank you so much.
All right, Bob. You're welcome, man. I'll see you in the World Series.
If you enjoyed these stories and want to hear more, please give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, or wherever you get your podcasts. Black Diamonds is also available on the SXM app, free for most subscribers. Just download it today and tap podcast. For more information on the Negro Leagues and the legends of the game, please check out our website, nlbm.com, and follow us on Twitter at NLBMuseumKC. Black Diamonds is part of the SiriusXM Podcast Network and is hosted by me, Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Additional voiceovers provided by Darnell Samuels. Editing and sound design by Rob Moore. Andy King is the director of sports podcasting for SiriusXM. Special thanks to SiriusXM's Senior Vice President of Sports Programming and Podcasting, Steve Cohen, and Vice President of Sports Programming, Chris Eno.
SiriusXM Podcasts.